Today's episode of The Compendium was sponsored by Critical Dice. Stick around for a special offer at the end of the show.
Welcome to The Compendium, a resource designed to help you spend less time learning D&D and more time actually playing.
Welcome back to The Compendium 2021. I think it's really funny that I feel like I measure this podcast in terms of the pandemic, because we literally, our first recorded episode was the week that it hit our city. And so I'm like, oh, 2021, this is exciting.
We did one episode like together, and then it was like, nope, yeah. never again.
We're back. We are, I'm really excited because we're taking a turn in a little bit of a different direction now that we have covered the gameplay rules of D&D. What we're going to start doing is a deep dive into individual elements of the game. And this is partly for DMs, and then also I think maybe depending on the topic, a little more heavily for players, so that you can feel more equipped to run your character or these encounters and kind of have a better feel on what these creatures or these players are kind of described as within the world of D&D. And so I think a really great place to start this new line of discussion is going to be talking about the races of D&D. And so before we get into that, I think it would be great to define a little bit what that term represents in this world, because our understanding on Earth of in present day and age of race is a little bit different than it's presented in the manuals, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah. And so, and that's the thing too, is like when you start D&D as a player, especially the first thing you're going to do is you're going to pick your race and your class. And so it's helpful to define our terms, what we mean by race in this context. And so when D&D uses the term race, they are surprisingly or not surprisingly using that term correctly. They're talking about divergent, mutually exclusive forms of humanoid life. And when you start to compare things like an elf to a dwarf, to a dragonborn, to a human, to an Aarakocra, like they're all clearly distinct forms of life that are different races under the classification perhaps of humanoid, which is how the game kind of does that. And unfortunately in our world, we ascribe that term race to other humans who are just slightly different than what we're used to, and do that by distinction of culture or language or where they were raised or the melanin content, which is part right. of what makes doing that so egregious, because we're really not that dissimilar. Our experiences are different, but we're all still humans. And so I like the way that D&D does this, because no, that term is correct. And in this, our world, we use it in a terrible, terrible way. And so when we use the term race for all of these discussions, and today we'll be talking about humans, know that that's what we're talking about, because these are clearly different kinds of peoples. And we may, of course, make mistakes and say person or human or character, but we're talking about sentient thinking beings with culture and family and friends and societies and things. And so we'll be looking at those different kinds of races. And then the other thing too, I want to kind of point out as well, is that I've seen, conversations, screaming matches, arguments on Twitter, especially where people were talking about like, hey, how dare you say that this particular race is always evil,
Right.
And the thing with that is simply this, is that what that is, I think, is one culture looking at the differences of another culture, of another D&D race, and then ascribing value to it based on their own understanding of good and evil and morals and social norms. And so if you look at a race that values battle and physical confrontation and violence as part of their social hierarchy, then a human culture or an elf culture might look at that and go, that's terrible. Like, that's so barbaric. That's so, so egregious. But yet you might look at their culture and go, well, you determine value in your society by education and money. And we think that's terrible because that keeps things the way they are and no one ever has a chance to move up. Mm-hmm. Gee, I'm glad that our world isn't like that. And so it doesn't mean that they are this flat out evil, nor does it mean they're flat out good. They are what they are. And you know, you have to kind of play with that as it is. But if two cultures or two societies can't reconcile those differences, they're going to naturally come to conflict. So that's why orcs aren't always evil, but rather their actions are diametrically opposed and their values are diametrically opposed to, say, many human races or many dwarf races and so on and so forth. And so, you know, I like to think that if goblins had their own monster manual, it would list dwarves as evil, maybe, and something like that. And so, again, I think all of this is a good, you know, precursor to this conversation about race and humanoids and things, and just understand what we're talking about when we say all these things. Take it with a grain of salt and remember, it's just a game. We're just trying to have fun. And hopefully this is a good jumping off point, don't you think, to like other people's conversations around their tables as they kind of have to deal with these kinds of things, right?
Oh, yeah. Because I mean, the concept of racism is, I think, just as important in D&D as it is in our world to have that discussion. And so depending on your table and the dynamics of the game and lots of other things, it might be a totally relevant piece to bring in. And your character might even have some of those like racist tendencies against this particular culture or other race because of an experience with them or a history clashing between your people or some other things. And so I think that's interesting. I mean, there might even be more what we would consider more traditional racism within your game in that, you know, humans or different types or different varieties of dwarfs or, you know, the elves. Maybe there's a racism between elves and drow. Like there could be these unique subsets that could come into play. And so I think it's important to have an understanding of what that means so that as a DM and a player, you can engage in that in a way that's constructive or beneficial and isn't going to be degrading to anyone or, you know, any person within the party or anything like that.
Yeah, exactly. And if, you know, if typically in novelizations or even in the rules and things, if, you know, it sets up this conflict with, you know, high elves or wood elves versus drow, the, you know, underground elves, but you're like, I don't want to do that. I don't feel comfortable with that. And also like, that's not constructive at my table or for my players, then right. Just don't do that.
They exactly.
Somewhere else. And maybe their culture and customs are strange and unusual, but there's no out and out antagonism for all this stuff. Or if, you know, your dwarf character always is, you know, has been in centuries long skirmishes and wars with orcs, but there's a half-orc member of the party, they're like, well, yeah, you're not part of that. So I don't hold anything against you in particular. I just, mm-hmm. you know, we're going to have to come to an arrangement here because, you know, my nation and your nation have classically been enemies, but it doesn't mean that you and I have to be enemies. So I think there's some good stuff there. You were telling me too, a good story about your warforged at your table.
Yeah. He brought in a really like kind of unique mechanic that he didn't really even tell me about on the onset. It was more just it came out in gameplay that he takes great offense to being called a robot to the point like that he's a Warforged fighter. And so he'll get quite defensive literally when somebody calls him that because to him that's racist because you know what, you can't tell us apart or whatever. And so there's areas that this can come into play. And if you do it well, if your DM is okay with it, if you're being considerate about how you're doing it, it can actually be a really fun like game mechanic to bring in some interesting storytelling or even character growth where somebody, you know, that dwarf that doesn't like orcs, maybe there's a half orc and they're opposed to them at the onset, but then there's this bond that's created through these shared experiences. And then that vision or that idea starts to shift throughout the gameplay. So there's actually, I think, an opportunity to really use that in a positive way. It's just kind of that conscious effort that's important.
Yeah. And as always, you know, have that conversation with your table, whether you're the DM or a player, and just figure out what everyone's comfortable with. You know, there are some very raucous games out there that I don't know if I would be comfortable playing in.
Right.
Other themes and things that I don't think my kids would be comfortable playing with, but other games, yeah, no problem. It's all okay. So just, you know, again, it's all about communication and defining terms and doing what is going to be beneficial and fun and push forward narratives for your game. So, yeah.
Right. So with that lead in, the first race that I would like to talk about is humans, because for a couple reasons. One, it's the most familiar to start off with for us because we are humans. Yes. But secondly, it's so, yeah, until we find out something different.
Yeah.
It's also, I think, one of the best races to start with as a new player, because again, yes, there's not all these interesting, weird little quirks or behaviors or where you were raised or these different elements that come into play. You can wing it a lot easier because you have firsthand experience on what it's like to be a human. So if you're just getting into D&D, humans, I think, are a good race to look at to consider for building your first character.
Yeah. And so conceptually, humans are very interesting because the way that the player's handbook describes them is short-lived and ambitious. And I really love that because, I mean, that really does kind of describe most of human history. We're like, listen, we know that we're dust. We know that we've got only a little while here. And the first part of it, we can't do much. And the last part of it, we can't do much. So we've got 30, 40, maybe 50 years of like good activity where we can make our mark on the world because we know that we won't be around to mark it. We have to leave our mark on it. And so we make cities, we make kingdoms, we gather resources, we build, you know, giant cathedrals and observatories and
libraries.
And libraries. Oh yeah. And writing and all that kind of stuff, because we know that, yeah, well, we've only got a little bit of time here. And it's why, you know, wizards might be humans oftentimes, because they're like, no, I'm going to find a way to get around all this. You know, their pursuit for clerical knowledge, for divine knowledge, for arcane knowledge, might, in quest for magic items and all this kind of stuff, really pulls in from that kind of short-lived and ambitious idea. But also too, I like the idea that conceptually humans typically work well with the other races because they understand the value of collaboration. You know, so like an elf might study for 3 decades for magic so they can do in one grand stroke build this amazing castle or create this, you know, this unusual effect, and they can kind of do it by themselves. Whereas humans know that we're better together. And if we can gather up a whole nation of people around a single goal, or a whole party around a single goal of killing the Lich King, then we can accomplish a lot more. And so they're going to be more open to working with others. Whereas, you know, dwarves might be a bit more skeptical of other people. Mm-hmm. Elves might go, well, I'll get around to it one of these decades, you know? And halflings are just like, well, you know, eat, drink, and be merry, because why not? And, you know, so it's very interesting. And I like how the player's handbook calls them everyone's second best friend, where it's like, they're not their first choice in dodgeball, but we'll take you to second round for sure, because yeah, humans are all right. You know, they get stuff done, and they're right on. You know, they typically will deal with you squarely. They're intelligent. They can accomplish a lot of things. And so I kind of like that. And I like the idea too, that this really common for them to be adventurers, right? So because they're like, well, I can do this or nothing, and I don't got a lot of time here. Yeah, exactly. YOLO, for tomorrow we die, maybe literally. They've got that great ambition. I kind of think like, you're not a huge Lord of the Rings fan, right?
I'm not a huge fantasy person, which is why I'm like so diametrically opposed to D&D in many ways, but...
Yeah. Well, I mean, Tolkien kind of puts forth this idea that, you know, dwarves are made of the earth, and so they're reliable and dependable, and they are, you know, kind of, they're not apt to rash decisions or making big movements because they're very much a part of the world that they're in. Elves with nature, they take the long view on things. The hobbits or halflings, they take home and hearth, but the humans are separate from this rhythm of the world, and they're going to act, and they're going to to have plans, and they're going to do all these things. And so it makes sense that, you know, a human might be kind of the linchpin of a party, because they're like, well, I've got to do this thing, and for the good of whatever, or because of my family, or because of whatever it is, and rally some of the others because they are untied to this rhythm of the world that's too long and too broad for them to see in their small context. And so I really like those concepts and ideas. And I tend to see that happening by accident or subconsciously a lot in a bunch of different games that I've been a part of or have listened to and things. So it's really interesting.
Yeah, they're basically, I mean, metaphorically speaking, they're kind of like the kids of the family, if you will, by, you know, the sentient species. In that, like, even in the player's handbook, if you want to follow along, page 29, but it opens with basically saying that they're the youngest of the common races. Mm-hmm. And if you think about it in the terms of a child, you know, you've got the parent that might be the elf. Mm-hmm. That has been around for a long time. They know not to touch the stove, but then you've got this kid that's just like, hey, this is cool. I want to do this. And so the type of thinking, that rhythm that you were talking about, doesn't quite exist yet because there hasn't been that longer period of learned behaviors or understanding. And so they're a little bit more action oriented or based.
Yeah. Cause they're like, what if we did touch the stove?
Right.
Yeah.
But hear me out. But hear me out. What if we did it?
What if we did it? But.
Right. And that's, that really struck me too, because I think just with, you know, living our daily personal lives, humans, you think about other races and D&D being like the odd ones, if you will, but realistically, the way this is presented, humans are going to be the weird ones. Like, they're going to be the ones people stare at because they're not going to be the most common to see populating places or other things because they've been around the least amount of time. They're kind of, if you will, like the aliens of the bunch in some respects, which was very interesting for me to consider. I had always just like automatically imagined worlds populated with humans. And then there's these other races that inhabit them, but it's actually the opposite. It's flipped. It's
the reverse. Yeah. Yeah. That's really interesting. And that's what was so great for a DM perspective. When you think about world building, you want to think about like, what are the relationships of these different races to each other? Yeah. Yeah. There may be, you know, 2000 year old, you know, human civilizations, but that's still kind of new kid on the block for a lot of the elves and the dwarves, especially. And, you know, while Dragonborn don't live a particularly long time, their great grandpappy is still alive because he's a giant red dragon. And so their perspective on, you know, power balancing and who the world really belongs to is a little different. And just thinking about and gaming out, like, you know, how do these things all kind of work? And, you know, or maybe you can go, okay, well, humans have been here for a super long time, but maybe they were relegated to a certain part of the world. And it wasn't until recent centuries that the rest of some of the other more magical races or long-lived races kind of like, oh, who are these guys? And they're like, oh, we've been around for a long time. We just were always like over here in Australia. And we kind of like made our way to this other continent. And now we're interfacing with you guys only for the last 150 years. It's going well, but, you know, we think of you as new and they think of us as new. And so, you know, how is that all going? So it was interesting to kind of feel all of that out. And, you know, I like the idea too that, or is it one big homogenous thing where, you know, the certain aspects of society, of a homogenous society, are they kind of run by different races? So like, are people who are into industry and wealth and treasury and building and crafting and forging, are those kind of typically the dwarves? Not always, but typically that way, because that's what they like to do. And a lot of the aristocrats and nobles and things, are those the elves? Because they're so stable, because they don't, their houses and their lands and titles, like, you know, English nobility doesn't change off that very often because they live for, you know, 1400 years or something.
Yeah, almost like the caste system or something, depending, different mechanics that you could use.
Yeah, exactly. And so, and I'm sure there's a number of great fantasy or sci-fi books out there that explore these themes that people will, I'm sure, shout at us on social media about, like, oh, it's like this, or it's like that, or like Discworld, or like this. Mm-hmm. And so I'm sure it's been explored, but it's a fun kind of concept to think about where humans have their place in the world. Was it just what they have? Did they have to fight for it? Did they have to carve it out for themselves? Was it granted to them by something? You know, were some of the oldest elves around when a certain god or two made the humans and then gave the elves like an edict of like, hey, treat these like your little brothers. They have their own destiny, but if they mess it up, we're looking to ask you what happened first. And they're like, oh crap, come on. I don't want to be in charge of another race. You know, who knows what it is, right? And then a few hundred years later, the gods are like, ah, never mind. They make the halflings, you know. So, you know, just kind of explore those things.
Yeah, it's fun when you start to tinker with some of those. Yeah,
absolutely.
One of the other cool things about humans is on that very first page. I think it's a good concept breakdown of what to expect from the humans as a race, which is the first heading is a broad spectrum, and the mm-hmm. second heading is variety in all things. And that really sums them up. Like that's what makes them unique out of these different races. And I know you've talked about this in the past in some of our other episodes, how humans are actually really great because they're not niched into one particular area that they're really good at. They're kind of good at they're kind of half good at a lot of things instead.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. We're I think what I've said before is like, we're not as fast as a horse, but we can actually out endure a horse in long distance running. You know, if we get hurt, like you think of like, you know, a wolf or a fox or something gets its leg caught in a trap, it probably won't recover. But humans, if we break bones with very little, you know, help or medical attention, we're probably going to recover and we're going to keep going and keep on trucking. You know, and where we lack the abilities of some other things, like we can't see in the dark, like an owl or a cat, but we're going to figure out other ways to work around our shortcomings, like, you know, inventing fire or harnessing fire at least, and all the applications that go with that into the Industrial Revolution and the Technological Revolution. And so we're always looking for our way to get our leg up in things. And so I really love that about humans because, as I've said many times, I love versatility when it comes to characters. I rarely make a character that is just good for one thing, like just a tank or just, you know, a spell slinger that can control the battlefield or just someone who's sneaky. I like to be pretty good at one thing, but then also have some things to kind of back up on right. as well. And so that broad spectrum that's there in the player's handbook is really great because it is a broad spectrum. I think there's a page here in the player's handbook, I'm flipping to it right now, I think, where even before the races, it talks about, gives you a little list of like what races would be good for certain classes, or no, I see here it is. It's on page 12. It talks about the ability score summaries and shows you which ones get bonuses to certain things. And by extension, you could figure out, my barbarian needs a good strength and constitution, which races have those. And in every single category, the good old human shows up because, and we'll talk about this mechanically, they get a +1 to everything.
Right.
And so there's not a single, like, listen, I mean, if you wanted to make a halfling barbarian, you could do that.
I have one in my campaign right now, and it is the best thing that has ever happened to me as a DM.
Yeah, I got to play one earlier in December, and it was a lot of fun. Like, you can do it, and it's fun, and we're laughing because it seems a little, like, a little mismatched, and that's what makes it fun. But I can't think of a single class that a human would play that would seem mismatched. You would go, yeah, that's fine. You know, dwarf sorcerer, it's a little odd, mm-hmm. but okay, you could roll with that. That'd be really fun to play, you know.
Caven sorcerer, Harry Potter, been there, done that.
There you go. Exactly. And so with humans, though, they can kind of do whatever. And so to loop back to your original comment, like for a new player, humans, yeah. Be a human. Don't feel like you're missing out on anything. It opens up all these options to you. And so you can concentrate on like, well, how do I be a cleric and what does all that mean, and not have to also keep cross-referencing back to these other things in the race, racial abilities that are going to like add extra stuff. Like, wait, I didn't choose that cantrip. Oh, I have that because I'm a tiefling. Got it. I forgot about that. You don't have to worry about that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I don't know magic, but you do know this one piece of magic.
Yeah, well, like, you do know this one thing, yeah.
Yeah, so things can get a little bit more wonky with other races. So humans a little bit more straightforward. Let's dive into when you're building a human. We're like Frankenstein here. When you're building a character that's a human race. I don't know how to phrase that better.
Building a human is called using a manual of golems. That's a little different. Or
we're not there yet.
Perhaps just pregnancy. But
there you go.
When you're creating a human character, I think is what we're looking for.
That's probably better.
Getting into the mechanics. So humans... I love it. It's hard to make generalizations about humans, but your human character has these traits. Thank you, Wizards of the Coast. You're right. So here's the key thing about them is most other races are going to get a +2 or a +1 to something. So they'll get a +2 and a +1. And sometimes that +1 or +2 is in the sub race, mountain dwarves versus hill dwarves, that kind of thing. With humans, there's no sub race for humans. And so what they've done here is something honestly unique to all of the so far races that I'm aware of, at least, is they just get +1 to all 6 abilities.
Which is more cumulatively than any other race, right? Because normally you get a +2 or a +3 to a single score, but this way you're getting +5 total across the board.
Right, but it's not a +2 where you know you're going to get a +1 to that ability score because you added +2 to it, you know?
Right.
But that calculation here is like you have to be a little more circumspect and careful, like, okay, well, how do I want to shave things just a little bit so I can get a couple of +1s to things? Here it's a little bit differently. And so you have to be not careful, but you have to be clever perhaps if you want to see a lot of bonuses off of your main 6 attributes. Your ability scores. It's really great because you just kind of, you're good at everything. And if you're using standard array or especially point by for that, that's going to get really fun really quick because you can be like, oh, I'm just going to give him my character an 11 for everything, which therefore gives him a 12. So he has a +1 to everything. And I might have points left over. This is great, which is a valid way to do that because humans are kind of good at everything or at least okay at everything. Let's go ahead and talk about the variant human traits because I think this is a good place to talk about that divergence.
Real quick before we get into that, can you define what a variant trait is? Because that's a new term we haven't really talked about. And so I think sending a foundation for what the heck is a variant before we talk about the human specific variant would be helpful.
Yes. So variant attributes for even a monster listing in the monster manual or for a playable race in the player's handbook, they will have things that are in little green boxes that say variant traits and then whatever the race is. And what this is that it's another option that you could do instead of what the basic way is. But because it's in a green box, that means that it's optional and you have to talk to your DM first. This isn't just a flat out, like, I can just choose this. Talk to your DM, make sure they're cool with it, and then you can do that. There are, the Mezzoloths, which are a kind of demon, I think, in the Monster Manual, they have a summoner's variant where they can actually summon more of themselves to the battlefield. And that's an option. It's not the standard, the factory default for that monster, but man, it makes it a lot of fun. And there's spell casting versions of kobolds, I think. I could be wrong on that, but there's all these variants. And so here you have a variant for the human. And I think it's one of the only, at least races in the player's handbook that does this. There might be one other I'm not thinking about. Oh yeah, the drow have drow magic as a variant, I think, under the elf listing. But so when you see that, here's another thing you could do instead, and they're going to take away some things and add some things. But as always, talk to your DM before you do that, and particularly for the human, because it includes and introduces the concept of feats, which is itself an optional rule. So by extension, this has to be an optional rule.
An option and an option.
Yeah. Yeah, Russian nesting dolls of character classes and races. So What this variant does is if your campaign uses the optional feats rules from chapter six, and I think almost everyone does because feats are a lot of fun, the Dungeon Master might allow these variant traits, all which replace your human ability score increased trait. And so instead of getting plus one to all your ability scores, what happens instead is this. You get two different ability scores of your choice to increase by one. Okay, so it strips out four of those bonuses, and it still has to be two different things. You can't stack both of them on strength or dexterity. You can stack one on strength and the other one on dexterity. And then what you get is you gain a proficiency in one skill of your choice. So you have that giant list of skills next to your ability scores and your character sheet. You can just choose one, right? And which is cool, because I think what they're doing here is they're saying, okay, so this lets you kind of kit out this human to maybe reflect their culture or the place that they're from, right? And so if all of them come from the forested mountains up north or something, then they're all going to have the survival skill. And so you're like, great, I'll just have the survival skill because that represents like how I grew up, right? Or if you come from a deeply religious city on the coast, then you might have religion as a skill. And that's just, everybody knows the coastal pantheon, and that's just, you're raised with that, no big deal.
Yeah.
And so you get that as well. And then the big one, which is why most people choose this one, and I choose it often as well, is you gain one feat of your choice.
Just
from the get-go. And the feats are really cool because there's a lot of things on there that could give you even more skills, or it lets you be proficient with a variety of new weapons that didn't come with your class, or even be a magic initiate where you could learn one first level spell and two cantrips from a particular class listing. And you're just like kind of just quasi magical no matter what, without
Jack
being a sorcerer.
Trades.
Exactly. And so one of my favorite characters I played for a long time was a human fighter who took that, and he took a magic initiate and learned some wizard spells. And then when it came time to get his subclass at level three, he chose Eldritch Knight. And so it was kind of a little head nod of where I wanted him to go eventually by having magic innate to him already. And it worked into his backstory and stuff, which was kind of fun. So so you can do all those kinds of things as well. And then Tasha's Cauldron of Everything, which is out now, has even more feats, like the Tavern Brawler feat, which is really cool. Brawlers, something like that though. Maybe it's just called Brawler. I can't remember now. Anyway, but there's a lot of cool feats in there. And so if you have a very specific build in mind that you're like, I want them to be good like this, or I want them to be like Batman, then doing a human variant as your race right off the bat lets you kind of start to dig into that, some of that stuff that normally wouldn't be available to you until fourth level. When you have the option at your DM's discretion to, instead of doing an ability score increase, to take a feat instead. And so that's kind of a fun way to do that, but it hinders you a little bit with the ability scores. So
yeah.
That's the trade-off.
Yeah, I think I think when you're making that choice, look more long-term.
Yeah.
It's probably not going to have a huge impact, especially if you're starting at a level one. It's not going to have a huge impact at the very, very beginning, but once you get to level four or five and beyond, when your proficiency bonus starts getting bumped and some other elements, some of these things can start getting amped up a lot, which can be super powerful. So if you're not sure if you want to do that or not, maybe consider the character and their ultimate kind of progression that you would see them having. And that might help you kind of decide between the two.
Do your players like map out their level progression in advance? Is that common at your table where they're like, in two levels, I want to do this, this, and this?
They have an idea, but I think it's more the concept of like a teenager that's like, hey, I'm going to go to school to study this, and then I'm going to get a job here. And that's their plan. But then as life takes turns, they adjust.
Yes.
So my Warforge, actually, he was a fighter bard when we started. And ultimately his character wanted to progress on the bard side, but because of all of the combat encounters, his character ended up leveling up into fighter because of the encounters that he was having. So it was counterintuitive to his character's plan for itself, but it was based off of the story and what was changing. And so I think that that's kind of what I mean when I say, like, if you're planning out your character, like, what do they want for themselves? Where do they see themselves being in 5 years? they might not get there, and that might take a total left turn, but it might help you get an idea of what that character would be pursuing or why they'd be pursuing it.
Right, because situations change, life happens, and as the old adage goes, man plans and God laughs. or characters plan and the DM laughs, as it may be. So yeah, so then we get to age. This is no surprise. In the D&D realms, it's the same as in real life. Humans reach adulthood in their late teens, physically, maybe not mentally, and live less than a century on average.
I really like how this, I mean, all of the D&D books are just really well written for many regards, but I like how it introduced them as being like the youngest of the races, and it talks about them like that. Like, they like have these really short little puny lives, and they live less than a century. Like, the way, even the wording, I think is helps support what they're saying. And it's just a fun little nuance to how they write. And it's just really neat to me.
Yeah, it's really great. And I love too that it talks about like the maturity age and then also like the life expectancy, which is really great. Mm-hmm. And like I looked over at Elf and they reach physical maturity about the same age as humans. But they typically will live, they aren't, you know, a full member of society until they reach age 100 and typically live 750 years. So 10 times an average human or so. So that's kind of fun. And you're right. It's very reinforces that point when it says they usually live less than a century. It doesn't say, you know, 7 or 8 decades. It measures it in centuries and we barely get there maybe. Like, mm-hmm. It's just like, okay, that's kind of a dunk on humans in D&D.
Yeah.
Like we measure things in centuries. How long do you live? Less than that. How sad for you. Next. and then alignment. Humans tend towards no particular alignment. Again, very broad. The best and the worst are found among them.
So true.
So this has more to do with, I think, the cultures and the inherent values of these races. Humans were just like, yeah, whatever you want. Which again, another great reason to choose humans. Whereas, you know, halflings, just one page earlier, I think they lean towards chaotic alignments. Lawful good. They're good, good-hearted and kind, so on and so forth. So it doesn't mean that you have to pick those things. That's just like if you encounter one of the members of these races, they're typically going to be like this, but it doesn't mean they're all good. It just means this is how they typically present themselves, but life gets in the way. Different people have different experiences and values, and some of them have larceny in their hearts. So alignment. Again, this is just a note. You don't have to pick it. And then size, humans vary wildly in their height and build from barely 5 feet to over 6 feet tall, regardless of your position in that range, your size is medium. And so the really only, you know, mechanical portion of that is your size, which some spells reference, your lifting ability references this as well, and so on and so forth. I used to work with a girl who was, you know, 4'11", and I work with someone now who's 6'5", and we all look at them all, go, huh, okay, that's interesting. But we don't go, wait, are they really human? You know, we have a wide variety of things. It's like there's a picture going around of a player from the WNBA and one of the cheerleaders.
Mm-hmm.
There's next to each other, and we're just like, wow, that's incredible, you know, because they're both obviously human people, but the height difference is so drastic. But that'll get us into some interesting things too when we get to dwarves, where we'll talk about that later. And then the speed, your base walking feet movement is 30 feet per round. You only have to track that in combat. And then languages, this is kind of fun. You can speak, read, and write common and one extra language of your choice, because again, humans are everywhere, they interact with everybody. Yeah, they are the second best friends of everyone. Humans typically learn the languages of other peoples they deal with, including obscure dialects. They're fond of sprinkling their speech with words borrowed from other tongues, orc curses, elvish musical expressions, dwarvish military phrases, and so on.
When I read that, it reminded me so much of Joss Whedon's Firefly.
Oh yeah, that's so good.
The world that he created and like how he blended the cultures that he was representing within that reality. And like they always cursed and they
were Mandarin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it was such a smart idea for TV because he couldn't really get in trouble for like saying curse words. But that's just what that reminded me of like these you know, they were speaking English, but at the same time, they were sprinkling in these words that were like immersed from their experiences, maybe living in cultures with these other people that speak other mm-hmm. languages. So that was the first thing that popped in my head. It's like, oh, it's like Firefly. Oh,
yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You know, the Goram ship and all that kind of stuff. Because in Firefly, actually, too, I think it's the Shinto something something alliance. Basically, it's like America and China got together back in the mm-hmm. past, and that's kind of why it's like that. So that's kind of fun as well. So yeah, so they get pick one other language, which is just whatever you want, really. My son actually was making a Warforged character today for a game and chose as his extra language Modron, which is D&D's version of binary, because he's playing a Warforged and that made sense to him. So just lots of languages to choose from.
Yeah, I'm trying to think, like, where would that come into play in a campaign?
I don't think it does. I think in his head canon, like all.
No, I love it. I love that he's being true to the Modron, character.
And so they can, like, you know, speak like clickwise or something to each other. You know, sound like a bunch of modems talking to each other, and they could tell their whole life story in a few seconds because it's a very efficient, you know, binary language or something. So, yeah.
And I mean, the thing is, too, I had a character that made up a language that they knew, because it was a language very specific to this tiny little place mm-hmm. that they grew up in, very secluded. And so for the second language, that's what they picked, even though they knew it wasn't really going to come into play in the campaign remotely. They just made one up, and that's, you know, depending on your DM again, but that was totally fine with me, because you were honoring your character, which to me is like the best way to go.
Yeah, totally. It's like speaking Gaelic or something, where it's like there's a few hundred thousand people on the planet who speak that, but go for it, right on.
Yeah.
Or there's that, there's a few islands off the coast of Charleston, South Carolina, where kind of close to where I grew up, and there's a dialect there that is super old, and like almost no one understands it except the people who are from there, because it's like this little pocket language that just never got integrated in anything else. So that's kind of fun as well. Yeah. So.
All right. Is there anything else with humans? I think that covers them.
Yeah,
and like we said already, they blend well with almost any class. And we're going to be deep diving into classes at some point too. But if you're looking for a good pairing suggestion, like wine and cheese, you know, they kind of go with everything. So you can just kind of take your pick of what sounds the most interesting.
Humans are like salt. They make everything better. Not too much of it.
In small doses.
Small doses, exactly. I'm sure how the other races feel. Oh, another
the second
human.
Best oh, friend.
Second best friend, exactly. Can we not get some pepper? Come on. Anyway, so that's humans. And you go buck wild and do a lot of cool, versatile things with them. And they're a great entry point, not because they're underpowered or simplistic, but because they're straightforward. You can, and malleable, so you can take them and bend them the way you want them to be for whatever concepts you have in your head.
Thanks for listening to The Compendium. This episode was sponsored by The Endless Bag of Dice. You can get a brand new set of dice to your door every single month for as low as $6.99. Listeners of The Compendium can get a special offer. Just use the code COMPENDIUM and get 50% off your first month of dice. Go to thecriticaldice.com and use code COMPENDIUM at checkout.
We hope you guys enjoyed this episode of The Compendium. If you haven't already done so, it would really help us out if you took a moment to subscribe to this podcast and leave us a review. Jason and I really enjoy creating this content, and it definitely helps boost our charisma modifier every time we see a 5-star rating pop up. The Compendium is actually also on Patreon, so if you like listening, that is a great way to help contribute to the content that we create. And you can always keep up with us between episodes by following us on social media. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you guys next time.